This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
You've seen them, those students or colleagues who are always taking the bull by the horns and plowing through projects and assignments on their own. In academia, these are called self-directed learners. Now a professor has used the concept of self-directed learning to analyze one of the greatest relationships in music history.
Paul versus John was off the charts, as they say, with respect to self-direction.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, did self-directed learning break up the Beatles? Then we'll hear about a group of students suing the state of Washington for a better environment. And we'll spend an academic minute finding out if testosterone makes us dumb. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. Did self-directed learning break up the Beatles? John Lennon and Paul McCartney were both great musical talents, but was Paul's greater self-directed drive responsible for the breakup of their band? David Kopp says, well, maybe. Dr. David Kopp is the Associate Dean of the School of Education at Barry University in Miami. He is also a professor of human resource development. In his new book on self-directed learning, he devotes a full chapter to the Lennon-McCartney relationship and explores how their different levels of self-direction may have been a major reason for the breakup. The book is called Famous and Infamous Workplace Training, A Social History of Training and Development. I spoke with Professor Kopp and first asked just what is self-directed learning?
Well, I'll tell you what it is by first starting with what it's not. It's more than just taking the initiative. That's certainly part of it. But self-directed learning as a self-training system includes not only taking the initiative to do something, but also evaluating the variables out there on how you're going to do that something, as well as getting the resources that you need ultimately. And then not only doing the project or the program, but at the end evaluating how you did. So it's a very sophisticated process that goes way beyond just taking the initiative or something.
You have to be pretty self-aware and know your strengths and weaknesses.
Well, you do, and it's a fair point because the jury is really still out as to are self-directed learners born or made. It's similar to the leadership argument. And my position is that, your personality and my personality, there are things that we're born with, and then some people are funnier than others, some people are smarter than others. Well, I think the self-directed learning, I think it's one of those characteristics that I think you're born with. Can it be improved? Sure. And certainly in my program, we look towards getting trainees who are self-directed and maybe giving them tips and techniques to make them more self-directed. I happen to believe it's something that, you know, you're either born with it or not. And if you're not born with it, you really have to take some measures to get better at it.
Are there times when it's just not a very good idea and, you know, a student is really going to need their hand held?
Well, it depends on the starting point. In other words, if you have a student that perhaps is underprepared upon receiving them, you may have to spend a little more time, as they say, showing them some techniques to be self-directed. And like kind of the small win theory, giving them little victories of completion, I think will start to get their confidence up and therefore could be self-correcting in that, the next project, maybe I'm going to see how much I can get done with myself without assistance from my trainer or mentor.
If someone feels they are self-directed and really wants to take the initiative, are they going to butt heads with some controlling professors along the way?
Well, you know, that really is the implication to the article I had written that, you know, self-directed learning on its face is certainly a characteristic that's sought out in either trainees, students, or otherwise, but I can picture a scenario that, if you have a very self-directed and assertive professor and a very self-directed and assertive student, that depending on how they work together, that could be problematic, as I suggest in my article.
Well, let's go to your latest book where you talk about self-directed learning as it pertains to the Beatles. How did that work its way in there?
Well, I've always been a Beatles fan, and it's a cliche, but their music has been the soundtrack of my life, as they say. And it was an opportunity once I got into academia to kind of take another lens on how I saw the Beatles. I knew, you know, all the popular culture aspects to their relationship and the group itself, but I decided to look at them from my research interest, which was self-directed learning, and what did it mean if people in a group, whether it's a rock group or a baseball team or a class, if people are working in teams, was it significant that there were differing self-directed learning competencies among and between the members? And so I decided to pose that question in the form of an instrumental case study using John and Paul within the Beatles.
What were their strengths? What were their weaknesses? Who was the self-directed learner of the pair?
Well, the upshot of my chapter in the book is that I take the position and kind of show the data to support it that Paul versus John was off the charts, as they say, with respect to self-direction. And there are instruments that we could use. And I obviously didn't have access to Paul, and John has passed, so I had to make and take some academic license on some of the data I pulled out to show the point that Paul was really a self-directed learner to the extent that he was known as what we call an autodidact, someone who really was so self-directed. It gets to your earlier point that, in fact, he could be a little pushy and obnoxious at times when there was a project completion date approaching. Now, that's not to say that John wasn't self-directed, especially compared to perhaps you and I. He was above average, but it was actually his relationship or his comparison to Paul that really was the point here. And between Paul and John, no question that Paul was the more self-directed.
And how did this deteriorate their relationship over the years?
Well, you know, I take the position that certainly there were other variables that deteriorated not only the relationship but ended the Beatles, you know, sex, drugs, and rock and roll being some of that. But I guess the point I was making is that in the beginning, when the music was very basic and raw rock and roll, there really wasn't a lot of opportunity or need for nuance in the production. And, you know, John, for all his bravado and strong personality, was the leader of the band. But as I track it over time, we find that as the production process became more sophisticated, you know, Paul took it upon himself to really observe and learn from George Martin, their producer. And it ultimately was to the exclusion of John. And, actually, in the book, I kind of portray that it was a battle of the A-sides. Now, you and I know what that means. A lot of my students don't know what an A-side is, but as we remember with the 45s, the commercially successful or thought to be successful song was put on the A-side of a 45, and of course the B-side would be something that was thought to be not perhaps as commercially successful. And in the beginning, John, from 64 to 66, certainly was winning the A-side battle just because he could. But as we get into 1966 and through Sgt. Pepper, of course, and things became a little more sophisticated, you see that Paul starts to not only win the A-side battle, but starts to take more creative leadership in the band. And admittedly, John, in biographies and in interviews, admits that, you know, he and George and the other Beatles ended up resenting the fact that Paul was actually leading the group and kind of dictating the schedule.
And if you look at their post-Beatles careers, I guess because Paul did albums where he played every instrument and John always needed an entourage there.
Yeah, it's a fair point. I mean, one of the aspects that I bring up is that while John Lennon was a genius, he was a facilitated genius. So before Paul, his best friend Pete Shotton kind of facilitated his hijinks, and then of course there was Paul, and then there was Yoko. You know, you and I may remember John's so-called lost weekend when he was just partying up with Harry Nilsson and Ringo, and that was the absence of a facilitator, and it was a disaster. I mean, he had Mind Games and I believe Walls and Bridges, which were fine albums, but I think he admitted that he basically was not tethered to anything and he was out of control. And then, of course, 18 months later, he got back with Yoko and he came out ultimately with Double Fantasy.
In the end, what can we learn from this relationship as it, you know, relates to self-directed learning or just any kind of relationship?
Well, I think one of the points I wanted to make is that when it comes to group dynamics, team dynamics, there are many things that we traditionally look at, like aspects of who's the gatekeeper, the opinion leaders are, is there effective communication, etc. What I'm introducing is another dimension to group functionality, and that is basically keeping in mind that the more self-directed players in and on the team may ultimately clash with those that are more in need of facilitation and vice versa. So I think, you know, let me be clear that I think in the absence of the differences in the self-directed learning, the Beatles would have broken up anyway because they were, in the end, they were family men and they had different interests. But if we needed just another variable, I would take the position the self-directed learning and the differences between John and Paul certainly facilitated the end. And as it relates to just everyday groups, I would say, you know, maybe keep in mind in some of the profiles of group members, when we put them together, we create groups. There are instruments out there that could tell us how self-directed someone is, and maybe that would help in forming groups in a more cohesive fashion if we had at least consideration to their SDL competencies. Because, you know, one of the implications is you don't necessarily want to put everyone with highly self-directed learning skills together in a group, and you don't certainly want, you don't want to put people who are not very highly self-directed. Maybe there is a strategic or a tactical mix of you know, putting teams together based on their SDL competency.
Okay, so in the end, Yoko is not off the hook.
You know, it's funny you say that, because one of the things, I was able to have dinner with Yoko in Soho, and I was at the time telling her what I was writing about, and she didn't disagree. I mean, she was very gracious and listened to my theory, but, you know, it's certainly, you don't want to start a conversation up with Yoko saying, you know, why'd you break up the band, type of thing. Of course she didn't. It was inevitable, and this was just something that added to it, this SDL difference.
And in the end, the love you take is equal to the love you make.
Dr. David Kopp is the Associate Dean of the School of Education at Barry University in Miami. His new book, which will be available in August, is called Famous and Infamous Workplace Training, A Social History of Training and Development. Still to come, students in the Northwest are going to court for a better environment. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. A group of young people are testing the limits of the liberty guaranteed in the Constitution. They are plaintiffs in a suit in Washington State that argues that a stable climate system is a constitutional right, one that's as inalienable as any right conceived by the Founding Fathers. The students have gone to the courts, met with the governor, and lobbied the state's Department of Ecology. Their latest strategy is unveiling proposed climate legislation, which they argue needs to be based on the best available climate science. Martha Baskin has their story.
The youth thought they'd secured a victory when a King County Superior Court in Seattle ruled in their favor this spring. The court directed the State Department of Ecology to issue new rules regulating greenhouse gas emissions by the end of the year. Ecology issued an updated rule this summer, its first since 2008, but it falls far short of what the kids and their lawyers say is required to stave off catastrophic climate change.
We have the laws on the books that say we need to protect air quality for present and future generations. We have a court order directing them to do so.
Andrea Rogers with the Western Environmental Law Center.
And what we don't have is action that's based on science.
Ecology is revising the rule after the public and Governor Jay Inslee weighed in and plan to present it to the legislature by the end of the year. But the youth and their lawyers aren't willing to wait and see what the revised ruling, the Clean Air Rule, mandates. So they announced at a press conference that they'd written their own legislation. Again, Andrea Rogers.
While we're pleased that Ecology used their authority to regulate carbon dioxide emissions, the rule doesn't get us even close to where we need to go.
The legislation, which was presented to both Ecology and Governor Jay Inslee in early September, is based on recommendations eminent climate scientist James Hansen and his team calibrated for the state. It calls for an immediate 8% reduction in annual emissions as a starting point from which to cut further over the coming decades. The state's revised Clean Air Rule calls for a much smaller cut of 1.7%. Hansen says governments worldwide continue to permit and otherwise support industry's efforts to fully exploit reserves of fossil fuels, something he calls, quote, at best schizophrenic, if not suicidal. 16-year-old Aji Piper, a youth plaintiff in the case, spoke at the press conference to announce the new legislation.
I know that we're asking for the moon, but wait, JF Kennedy asked for the moon, he got it. So why can't we children ask for the moon?
Going to the moon was optional back then, Piper told the crowd.
Our rights and obligations are not.
The idea that children or anyone have a right to a stable climate system, says environmental law scholar Mary Wood of the University of Oregon, is a fundamental one and goes back to the public trust doctrine, whose roots come from early Roman law. The doctrine states that the public has property rights to natural resources, water, land, shorelines, and even the atmosphere. Wood spoke with FSRN after the youth court case in Washington was heard late last year.
And this has been interpreted as a constitutional principle with constitutional implications in the sense that it holds even legislatures accountable and certainly agencies accountable like Department of Ecology.
The atmosphere, she emphasizes, is a public trust asset, which means government is a trustee and as such has a fiduciary obligation to protect it.
So it's really a very simple construct. As much as the agencies, the government attorneys, and certainly the industry want to complicate the matter, at some fundamental level, there's no complicating this right.
But even in a state like Washington that touts its green credentials, acting on this public trust doctrine and James Hansen's recommendations is open to interpretation. Chris Davis, Governor Inslee's advisor for energy and carbon markets, contends that the need to reduce carbon by 8% a year, or 10% by 2020, is a global target.
There is very little at all that I've seen science that explains how a small jurisdiction should downscale that data and decide what they're responsible for.
Davis contends that after last year's Paris climate talks, jurisdictions began trying to figure out how to set their limits. At the same time, he says the state is taking notice of California's new climate change law, which has a target of reducing emissions 40% below 1990 levels by 2030. Aji Piper isn't wasting any time waiting for action. He and others are using another tactic to influence the outcome of their court case and the Clean Air Rule, mailing letters to the CEOs of prominent corporations with a heavy carbon footprint in the state, along with those who have verbalized support for annual carbon reductions of 1.7%, which include BP, Chevron, and Shell. Piper also wrote a letter to the CEO of Puget Sound Energy, who generate about a fifth of their energy from a coal-fired power plant in Montana.
Do you know what climate change is? Do you really know what climate change is? Ask yourself this question.
Addressing the crowd at the press conference, Piper added that it was generally accepted that with great power comes great responsibility.
It is also accepted that knowledge is power. So if you have knowledge, I ask you to take responsibility by reducing your business's carbon dioxide emissions by 8 to 10% every year.
Meanwhile, a youth-initiated federal climate rights case is being heard in Oregon. Juliana et al. Versus United States et al. Challenges the constitutionality of what it calls the nation's, quote, outsized role in creating the present climate crisis by authorizing, subsidizing, exploiting, and permitting fossil fuel projects and their lethal climate emissions. The government and three trade associations representing the fossil fuel industry filed motions to dismiss last year. The motions were overturned this spring, but the defendants again objected to the court's ruling. U.S. District Court Judge Anne Aiken will now hear oral arguments from lawyers representing all of the parties. Thanks to Ed Mays for video clips used in this story. This story was originally produced for FSRN and is brought to you by the Human Links Foundation. Engineering by Daniel Gunther. From the studios of the Jack Straw Cultural Center, this is Martha Baskin.
Testosterone is responsible for a lot of functions in the body, but does it make you more likely to goof up? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Does testosterone increase mental mistakes? I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Colin Kammerer, professor of behavioral economics at the California University of Technology, examines this question.
Testosterone is a hormone that affects reproduction and all the drama surrounding it. When a male animal comes across an attractive mate or a threatening competitor, testosterone is released into the bloodstream and brain. The ideal way to test its effects is to change testosterone in one group of men and see how they behave differently. That's exactly what we did in our research. We recruited 243 men. We either increased the testosterone by having them apply a gel to their skin or had them apply a placebo gel that feels the same but has no active ingredients, and they couldn't tell which gel they'd got. Then the men all took a test. The test was three brain teasers to measure cognitive reflection. Here's one. Suppose there's a small amount of algae in a pond. The algae doubles every day and completely covers the pond after 48 days. On what day is the pond half covered in algae? The intuitive response is that the pond is half covered in 24 days, because 24 is half of 48. But that's wrong. The correct answer is that the pond is half covered on the 47th day. Remember, the algae doubles every day, so it must be half covered on day 47, in order to be fully covered on day 48. The men who had their testosterone increased made more mistakes on these brain teasers. They got only about 1.5 right, and they answered fast even when they were wrong. The placebo subjects got 2 right. So testosterone seems to increase mental confidence, which is bad when you're solving brain teasers. But the biological purpose of testosterone is maintaining male drive and status for reproduction. Why would it also lead to more mental mistakes? Our hunch is that testosterone increases mental confidence, which increases status, which must lead to reproductive opportunities somehow. So testosterone is probably doing its number one job after all, enhancing reproduction, but through a roundabout route in the brain.
That was Colin Kammerer of the California University of Technology. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org. And you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.